What is Zionism? What is its history? And what is its opposition, anti-Zionism? And what constitutes this history? The conversation has gotten so loud, yet it seems people don't really know the definitions of the terms themselves. It's time to cut through the rhetoric, noise, slogans, and soundbites and offer the debate an intelligible context. Join us to journey through the historical roots of this debate.
The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
In each episode, we will explore how every type of Zionist thought was opposed by a certain brand of anti-Zionism. And we reflect on how these various debates persist to this day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode one of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the History of Two Opposing Ideas. I have the great pleasure of being here today with Dr. Anat Wilf, who is a leading thinker on Israel, Zionism, foreign policy, and education. She is also a former member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. 2 years ago, while a student at Georgetown, I had the privilege of taking Anat's course while she was a visiting professor at the university. Her course was a transformative learning experience for me, and we are bringing a version of it to you today. In recent years, it seems that Israel, Zionism, the Jews, and the Israeli-Arab conflict are somehow brought to the center of all arenas. The conversation is unavoidable. From Hollywood, to Congress, to campuses, to sports, to publishing, you name it, it's there. And yet the relevance isn't always clear. The topic provokes such intense emotion, and yet sometimes it's hard to know why. Often, we don't know what it is we're talking about, and so instead, we continue to talk past each other. Zionism and anti-Zionism. Before we champion one cause or the other, shouldn't we begin from a precise definition of what these terms mean? Otherwise, isn't the conversation pointless? Stick with us over these next 5 episodes to cut through the noise and to understand the crucial history behind these terms. This series isn't a history on the Israeli-Arab or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The history of Zionism and anti-Zionism starts long before these conflicts erupted. The following history is that of how these two ideas formed. And as a result, we might have a better understanding of where we find ourselves today. For our first episode, we begin with the origins of political Zionism in the 19th century. Our first pairing is political Zionism versus emancipation. How did the Jewish people arrive at this moment, at these two different ideas for their future? Here to take us through it is Dr. Anat Wilf. This is The Historical Breakdown.
Hello, everyone. Before we delve into a discussion of Zionism and anti-Zionism, the thing that was most important for me to emphasize when I taught the course in Georgetown was for the students to learn to think like contemporaries. When Zionism emerges as a political idea, as a movement, it is far from being the dominant idea among Jews. There are many other ideas vying for Jewish support. Zionism, in many ways, was a marginal idea. The problem is that we tend to think of history as inevitable. We know where we are today, and we think that the establishment of Israel, the success of Zionism, were inevitable. We draw a straight line. Herzl had this idea, then people implemented it, and presto, we have the State of Israel. But at every single moment, Zionism was not inevitable. There was nothing about the success of Zionism or the establishment of the State of Israel that was assured. And what I wanted the students to understand is that as they were reading the texts of the contemporaries, they needed to put aside their current knowledge that the State of Israel exists, that Zionism was successful, and to learn to think like the contemporaries, that there are many possible ideas, all of which might actually triumph. Before we begin to discuss Zionism and emancipation, we need to understand how we got to this point in Jewish history. And for that, of course, we need to go a little back.
The origin story of the Jewish people is found in the Hebrew Bible. As it is told, God commanded Abraham to leave Mesopotamia and go to a land promised to him and his descendants, the land of Israel. For several generations, Abraham's descendants lived in the land until a famine forced them to settle in Egypt, where they later became enslaved. Fast forward a bit, and God commands a new prophet, Moses, to lead Abraham's enslaved descendants, the Israelites, out of Egypt and take them back to the land of Israel. On the way, Moses and the Israelites received the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, from God, symbolizing the official coronation of the Israelites as a unified collective. At this point, the era of mythology, as Dr. Wilf dubs it, ends, and the era of history begins. Generations later, in the land of Israel, King Solomon builds the first holy temple in Jerusalem, signifying the spiritual and collective center of Israelite life. In the 10th century BCE, some of the Israelite tribes established the Kingdom of Judah, Judea. In 586 BCE, the Babylonians destroy the first temple, sending the Judean people into exile. In the following centuries, the land was conquered by different empires. Eventually, the Judeans were permitted to return and rebuild the temple, only for them to be exiled again, and their second temple destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. At this point, the Romans renamed the land of Israel, Palestina, as a means to sever the connection of the Judean people to the region. Here begins the era of Diaspora Judaism, religious and cultural innovations with the goal of ensuring the survival of Judaism and the Jewish people in exile abounded. The Talmud, the synagogue, new Jewish languages, communication and trade networks, and much more. Religious and cultural persecution followed as well. Second-class status in Christian and Muslim lands, violent persecution during the Crusades and Spanish Inquisition, and professional limitations. In this era, the Jewish people were dispersed all over the world. Two main cultural and religious groups emerged, Ashkenazi and Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews. Ashkenazi Jews were those who lived in Europe, mainly Central and Eastern Europe, and Sephardi Mizrahi Jews were those who were expelled from Spain in 1492 and or lived in the Middle East and North Africa. Each group developed their own religious rituals, cultural norms, and languages. Throughout these eras of Jewish history, we need to remember that like all histories of a people or civilization, the Jewish people did not exist in a vacuum. They engaged with and responded to their political and cultural environments, whether it was the rise and fall of pre-medieval empires, the clashes between and within Christian and Islamic empires, the cultural world of Islamic Spain, the social scene of medieval Poland, the intellectual climate of the Enlightenment, or the rise of nationalism, the Jewish people were engaged with the world around them. At each stage then, Zionism and anti-Zionism was a product of not only the evolutions occurring in Jewish life, but also the things going on in the wider political and cultural worlds Jews inhabited.
When we think of any people, the first thing to learn about them is their geography. When you know about the geography, it tells you a lot about who these people are. And the most important aspect of the geography that has shaped the Jewish people is that the geography is one of passage. The land of Israel, is essentially a passage between Africa and Asia, Africa and Asia and Europe. And as a result, we can see that the people of this land have been shaped by stories of passage. The foundational mythologies of the Jewish people, whether Abraham, Lech Lecha, who goes from Mesopotamia to the land Or later, our other foundational mythology, Exodus, from the Nile Valley civilization, from Egypt, going into the land, you can see that the foundational mythologies of the people shaped by this land are stories of movement, of passage. Even the name of the people initially, the Hebrews, Ivrim, Ever, literally means passage. The Jews are the people of passage. And because the land is one of passage, the people in the land are shaped by the rise and fall of more powerful empires in the centers of civilization in that region, Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley. So as we move from mythology into history, we begin to speak of the Israelite kingdom. These people are now the Israelites. And again, an empire rises to the east, the Babylonian Empire, Mesopotamia. It brings down the Israelite kingdom. The people are exiled. When they are exiled, they sit on the rivers of Babylon. They remember Zion. And then another empire rises. Persia brings down Babylon, brings back many of the exiled. Over time, they establish the second Judean kingdom, now called Judea. And then another empire rises to the west. The Roman Empire brings down the Judean kingdom, exiles those people. And just here, I went over 2,000 years of mythology and history that already gives you a sense of who these people are. They are a people shaped by passage and by the rise and fall of empires. During the Roman exile, this is when we really begin to speak of the Jewish people, which in every language except English and French are known as the Judean people, Yehudim, Yehud, Yudio, Yudaya. So it is understood by the world that the Jewish people are essentially the people of Judea once exiled. Now, given that these people have already been exiled before, that their understanding of themselves is one of movement, that they have an expectation that something will replace the Roman Empire and bring them back to this land. And something does replace the Roman Empire, but it changes the course of history. And that is, of course, the rise of Christianity and later Islam, both who emerge from Judaism and especially from the Jewish idea of the universal God. But what Christianity does is that it untethers the Jewish innovation of a universal God from its connection with the specific tribe of the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews. It untethers it from the connection with the people, with the tribe, and with the land, which is what makes the spread of Christianity and later Islam possible. It has been so successful that half of the world's people today are either Christian or Muslims. And both Christianity and Islam develop a somewhat complicated, fraught relationship with Jews who continue to live and refuse to accept the final truth of Christianity or the final prophecy of Islam. Obviously, a lot of Jews converted over the ages. If not, who knows, perhaps there would have been 500 million Jews today. We're only 15 million. Which means that many Jews converted, but the ones who live today are essentially the descendants of those who rejected the promise of Christianity and Islam. As a result, in both the lands of Christianity and Islam, Jews were set aside. And to be a Jew under those conditions, you had a binary choice. You were either in or out. And if you were in, being Jewish was a package. It was a people, a tribe, a nation. You had a covenant with God, common texts and common rituals. So what bound you together as a people was the past and the present. Through the expulsions, through the discrimination, through the misery, was also the idea that you were bound together by a common future. The common future was the one of restoration in the land of Israel to be sovereign again. And then comes modernity. And modernity introduces a whole lot of new ideas. Most prominently, the idea of the citizen, the idea of the secular citizen of the republic, the separation of church and state, the idea that it is people who will choose their leaders rather than rulers being divinely ordained. And there is a question, can the Jews now be brought in? And the answer is yes. The Jews can become citizens of the newly established secular republics and nations of Europe. And this opens the question that will determine the future of emancipation and Zionism, ultimately known as the Jewish question. Can Jews become full, equal, loyal citizens of those new republics? So the ideas of the equality of human beings, the rights of man, the equality of citizens, really erupt on the world stage with the American and later the French Revolution. And as the question emerges, are the Jews in? Can they become citizens? The issue is debated in the French Parliament after the Revolution. And it is a debate on the status of three groups that until that moment were outside Christian society: executioners, actors, and Jews. And the answer is yes, they can now become French citizens. And this is the process that we call emancipation. It sweeps through Europe throughout the 19th century. Jews are given legal equality, equal rights across various nations and states in Europe in the 19th century. They can now become French, German, Italian. They are equal citizens and they partake in the equal rights. And Jews respond to that invitation. They leave the ghettos, they change how they dress, they adopt the languages of the nations, no longer speaking Yiddish, they become French, they become German, they help shape those nations. And it is a moment of promise when you hear about the contributions of Jews to literature, to sciences, to arts. A lot of it is from that moment of emancipation. There is a caveat, and the caveat is presented in that same debate in the French Parliament, and it's presented as follows. To Jews as individuals, everything shall be given, but to the Jews as a people, everything shall be refused. What does it mean? It means that as individuals, as citizens, everything shall be given, everything is equal rights, citizenship. They are individual citizens of a republic, but they can no longer be thought of as a people. So the package that was Jewish life is essentially broken apart by emancipation. Jews are asked to take all the elements that show that they are a collective, a people, a nation, a tribe, and to set it aside. And they can keep individual elements like faith and ritual. And this is the moment that Judaism is reconstructed, you could say even relegated, to the status of religion. The most common mistake made in the West is to think of Judaism as a religion. But the idea that Judaism is a religion is actually a 19th century Western construct intended to fit the Jews into the idea of the secular republic. So the Jews are no longer Jews by nation, they are now French by nation and Jews by religion. They can be French of the Mosaic faith. But we need to understand still that emancipation was a moment of great excitement. The poet Yud Lamed Gordon wrote about emancipation in Russia with the reforms of Tsar Alexander II. He speaks about the fact that the old hatred has been erased, and now it is actually up to the Jews to answer the stretched hand of their fellow neighbors. He calls them to be a man, Adam, a person, when they go to the public square, but to be a Jew at home. The idea that being Jewish, Judaism, is now a private matter, but when they go to the public square, they are a man. They are human beings equal to their French, Russian, German compatriots. And this is the promise of emancipation. Now, emancipation is not anti-Zionism per se. Zionism is yet to be born. But it creates the first alternative to what will later become Zionism, the idea that the Jews can be French, German, Russian by their collective identity, but Jewish by their private religious identity. So emancipation creates this great century of promise. And in many ways, the Jews succeed and ascend to new heights once Europe essentially invites them in. But with the success of emancipation, there is also the rise of different ideas. The idea of equality is still very difficult, it's still new. And now a scientific, pseudo-scientific idea is emerging to say that actually human beings are still unequal, but not under God, now under science. Humanity is now divided into races, and the Jews are now designated as a different race, the Semitic race, which of course makes no sense, and yet Jews are designated by others, not by themselves, as a separate race, the Semitic race with immutable characteristics. And there's the rise of this new ideology, anti-Semitism, the notion that Europe cannot truly be Europe unless it removes the Semitic stain from its midst. And there was one person who really believed in the promise of emancipation. His name was Theodor Herzl. He moves from Budapest to Vienna. He wants to be a German playwright. Now we know Herzl as the modern visionary of the State of Israel, but that's not what he wanted to do. He believed that in living at the end of the 19th century in cosmopolitan Vienna, it doesn't matter that he was a Jew. He will be a German playwright. And he goes to University of Vienna, he studies law, and initially he's accepted, he becomes part of a very prestigious fraternity. But then he sees the rise of this new ideology of anti-Semitism. And today we forget that at the time, anti-Semitism was progressive, modern, scientific, very popular in university campuses. And Herzl sees the rise of anti-Semitism among his friends, among his colleagues to the fraternity. He sees it grip Vienna. He later sees anti-Semitism grip Paris, the birthplace of the Republic and the rights of man. And he says, okay, I got you. You Europeans, you talk the talk of equality. You have beautiful, noble ideals. But when it really comes to treating us as your equals, you can't walk the walk. You just turn around and tell us the same old thing, that we don't belong. So you know what? When we agreed to set aside the idea that we were a people, a nation, a collective, as the price of entry, that was wrong. And Herzl declares we are a people, one people. And with that one phrase, he erases a century of emancipation, saying the Jews are a people, no less than the French, no less than the Germans. And since we are a people, and now various peoples are organizing themselves into nations, into states, then the Jewish people have the same right as all these other people to govern themselves by themselves in their own sovereign state. And where else, of course, than the only geography where the Jews ever made sense as a people to which they were ever connected, where they always wanted to be restored, the land of Israel. And this is the birth of Zionism as a political idea, the idea that the Jewish people as a people and a nation can restore themselves once more in the land of Israel as a sovereign people. One parent of Zionism is, as we discussed, the ancient, continuous connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. That is one parent of Zionism. But that is not enough, because if the Jews had only continued to wait, to long, to pray, the modern state of Israel would not have come into being. The other two parents of Zionism is one the sense of betrayal of emancipation, the understanding that Europeans will never let Jews truly be their equals, full members of their nations. And the third parent of Zionism is the rise of the nation state to replace empires. Beginning at the 19th century, the idea emerges that to replace empires, people will be governed by themselves in nation states where they are all equal citizens. And this is Zionism. When Herzl writes Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, the state of the Jews, he doesn't think Jewish like a Catholic or Protestant or Muslim. He thinks Jewish like English, Jewish like German, Jewish like French. The Jewish state, the idea of Zionism, is the idea of a secular state for Jews and non-Jews alike. Now, one of the things that characterizes Zionism, Zionists have very fierce critiques of the life of Jews in what is still at the time called exile, the Galut. We sometimes look at these criticisms and it appears very harsh, but there is an understanding there that no less than power corrupts, we all know that power corrupts, what early Zionists understood, that powerlessness corrupts no less, that the need of Jews to constantly ingratiate themselves, to be at the mercy of others, to have others determine whether they live or die, also corrupted the soul. And Zionism, therefore, was also a healing idea. It was not just about being sovereign in their own state. It was also about healing the Jewish condition, allowing Jews to stand upright, to be proud, to be healthy by the fact that they will be living as citizens, just like the French, just like the Germans, in their own country, in their own land.
So to clarify the timeline, the Jews were in the Kingdom of Judea. The Romans came and exiled them, at which point the land was renamed Palestine. And from there, the Jews don't return until political Zionism and the creation of the state in 1948.
Yes. I mean, again, there's a continuous presence of Jews in the land, especially in the four holy cities known as Jerusalem, Tiberias, Hebron, and Tzfat. And over the centuries, there are some ideas and some efforts, but really it's not until political Zionism when there is a real organized and ultimately successful effort to reestablish the Jews.
So it's difficult to define the Jewish people, but through what we've heard, we understand that Jews are a nation. Herzl says we are a people, one people, and that Jews have tried in vain to integrate everywhere, but are aliens. Another Zionist, Jacob Klatskin, said the Jewish people are members of one family, bearers of a common history, and that the reason Jewish people in exile resisted total annihilation is because they lived on spiritually as a nation. Yet today it seems that people don't really have this understanding of the Jewish people, and many people refer to Judaism only as a religion, which we've now learned is something that's only a very recent reconfiguration. So all of this to say, how do we best define the Jewish people?
The idea that Judaism is just a religion, the way that many people think of religion in the West, is something of faith and ritual and maybe some communal, local communal aspect, really fails to kind of appreciate and bring out what Judaism really is, which has this very powerful collective element, the tribe, the people, the nation. It's only under modernity and the establishment of the idea of the citizen in the modern nation state that Jews are basically asked to tear apart, to break the collective identity in order to adopt the collective identity of their nation, France or Germany, and only keep those elements of Jewish life that could fit into those nation states so they can be Jews by religion, but not by nation or people. But I still think the best way of understanding the Jews is first and foremost as a collective identity, and I believe a tribal identity in many ways comes closest.
So when we think about the history of
ancient Christian anti-Semitism or the persecution that Jews experienced in Europe and around the world, what made them so excited for emancipation? Why were there some Jews who thought this could actually work after so many centuries of being viewed as the other?
So the main reason that emancipation seemed like such a promising idea is because it included all these modern notions of the rights of man and the equality of human beings and secularization and the rise of science. The idea was that Europe is breaking with its Christian past. Today, for example, many places in the West, and we'll talk about it, are governed by a branch of Christianity that came much later, that became pro-Israel and pro-Zionist. But early Christianity, precisely because it emerges from Judaism and seeks to supersede it, it has the New Testament, it has the new truths, it has a problem with the fact that there are still Jews who reject Christianity. And Christianity has a theological problem that it needs to explain. It needs to explain why Jews still exist. Now, I know that sounds harsh, but Christianity had to explain that. And the way that they explained it is to create a whole theology that said that the fact that Jews still exist is because they have a role. And the role of the Jews is to suffer. The role of the Jews is to serve as a cautionary tale to their Christian neighbors as to what happens to those whom God has no longer chosen, to those who reject God's Messiah, who reject Christ. So the idea was that it is the role of the Jews to suffer, to be miserable, to be stateless, to be powerless in order to be this effective cautionary tale. And this is why Jews are clearly set apart from Christian society until modernity. And because modernity claimed to do away with religion, there's no more divine rights of kings. It is now the people, the nation, who will elect the rulers. Because the feeling was that this is a modern break with religion, Jews could believe that now it would be different because you would no longer have the kind of Christian religious underpinnings of Jew hatred, this theology that Jews need to serve as a cautionary tale, of course, also for their sin. The feeling was that now they're entering into a world of modernity, of science, that would no longer be governed by these ancient superstitions, and that's why Jews could believe in it.
Zionism was born out of a concern of what it does to a people to be oppressed for so long, and it became a revolutionary liberation movement for self-determination for the Jewish people in their indigenous homeland. And in the West, this was originally a progressive cause. So progressives supported this idea.
So first, you were completely right in saying that Zionism was a movement of liberation and especially of self-liberation. One of the most dramatic revolutions of Zionism is that it moves from being passive, essentially Jews saying we're going to wait for God to send the Messiah. At the end of every Passover Seder, we'll say to next year in Jerusalem, but who knows? So moving from a very passive stance to one of action in history. And that's why also Zionism, certainly at the beginning, was a very secular movement, because it basically said, we're done waiting, we're done praying, we're done waiting for God to send his Messiah, we're going to be our own messiahs. Zionism was a movement of self-redemption, self-liberation, and it was influenced by the rising ideas of self-determination, that rather than having empires govern people, people will govern people. That was the idea of national self-determination. That is one of the parents of Zionism, and it's a universal principle. And of course, the idea of self-liberation, and certainly of one of the world's longest oppressed people, really people whose very oppression and misery was a theological need, the idea that those people will rise in history and will self-emancipate, self-determine, liberate themselves, that is, of course, the very idea of human progress when we speak about progressive ideas.
Yes. And apart from the condition of the Jews in Europe was unique, but the desire for self-determination wasn't. And the Jews were just one group, like the Poles, the Czechs, who were also looking for self-determination and their own nation state. So it's not unique in that context, but it is unique in the sense that you're returning after 2,000 years of dreaming about it.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the principle of self-determination is a universal principle. It's basically the principle that has shaped the world. We can say that the 20th century begins when much of the world is divided between empires, and it ends when much of the world is divided between states, and when they're lucky, they're nation states of self-determined people. When they're unlucky, colonial powers drew their borders. When they're lucky, it was a self-determination and they were able to determine themselves in their land. So it's a universal principle, and Zionism is based on the universal principle of self-determination. But it's true that even though there was a continuous Jewish presence in the land throughout the millennia, the vast majority of Jews lived outside the land of Israel. And in order to self-determine, in order to liberate themselves, most of them had to come here.
Does Zionism inherently mean that the Arabs who were living there, now the Palestinians, that they must necessarily suffer as a result of the movement?
Absolutely not. And when you read the early Zionist writings, they're very clear on the idea that this will be good for everyone. So you might argue that the early Zionists were naive, but you could definitely not argue that they had ill will. So ever since the 7th century conquests by Arabs and Muslims of the entire Middle East and North Africa, very successful conquests, the people of the land became identified as Arab, as Muslims, ultimately under the Ottoman Empire. And when Zionism imagines the Jews rebuilding a state, a sovereign state, they understand that a few things have transpired since the last time that the Jews, the Judeans, were sovereign in the land. They understand that there are people who are now Arabs and Muslims. And there is a complete expectation that they will be equal citizens of the Jewish state. This is very much the vision of Herzl, both in der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, and in Altneuland. He believed that precisely because Zionism was not a colonial movement, it didn't come to exploit. It didn't come to take things from a land and bring it back to some metropole. They came to a land which certainly, until fairly recently, had no natural resources, was considered an absolute backwater, was very sparsely populated. It was not a central place of the Ottoman Empire or of the region. It's not Alexandria, it's not Baghdad, it's not Beirut, it's not Damascus. So there's an understanding that because the Jews were coming with good intentions to build, to create, to develop, they will be welcomed. Now, again, you could argue this was entirely naive, but there was no ill will. There was a complete belief that Zionism would actually do good for the inhabitants of the land as well as for the Jews, and that it would liberate everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for staying with us through our first pairing, Political Zionism versus Emancipation. Stay tuned for our next pairing in episode 2. Thank you very much.